Dark Wreath Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn Semester 2009, this is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 7. Lecture 5, delivered on September 1 of 2009. The title of this lecture is The Structure of an Interest Rate.
Today, the structure of an interest rate. I begin by briefly talking about the Federal Reserve. I had you read a two-part series, The Federal Reserve Under Fire, which I wrote, which got me more notoriety than I would have cared. Well, no, I don't mind. The bottom line is that the Federal Reserve has inordinate, large influence over the economy. And that influence is principally through its power over interest rates. And that power is definite in the short run. And in the intermediate run, it is quite notable. In the long run, it has not as much power. But what power it does is generally of an adverse nature if the Federal Reserve has not carried out responsible policy in the short run. I therefore strongly encourage you, if you have not gotten through those articles or if they are still opaque to you, read them again. But the truth of the matter is that interest rates dominate finance. And they come in all different flavors and terms. The words interest rate are going to be supplanted by other terms, which are the same thing as interest rates. Yield, APR, discount rate, effective rate, internal rate of return, weighted average cost of capital, return on assets, return on investment. All of these are fancy ways of saying an interest rate. And so I have to bring you to bear on what an interest rate is. Look, the tradition in finance is to just wave off what it is that we're talking about, an interest rate, and just go ahead, let's use it. Like here's an interest rate. Never mind what it is. Never mind what its structure is. Let's just use it. But if you were to be effective in financial management, in investments, and in capital markets analysis, you have to know what an interest rate is. More broadly, though, because you are going to be informed, college-educated citizens of the world, may God help us, you are going to be the shock front of the knowing. You are going to be the ones who are not dumb, the ones who listen to stupid explanations and to silly mythical folkloric ideas. You're going to be the ones who actually know what's going on, at least theoretically. And I will damn well be sure that when you come out of here, I can say, yeah, they do know what's going on. I taught them myself. Here's the thing. The Federal Reserve has one and only one goal with respect to monetary policy. That goal is stability of the aggregate price level. That is its only goal. Stability of the aggregate price level. It is not there to help the economy, to hurt the economy, to boost this president or damage that president, to pander to the fears of a particular period. It is there to conduct a monetary policy that controls the aggregate price level so we do not have inflations and we do not have deflations, because both of those have adverse effects on finance, on the financial world. In the truth of the matter is that inflations help borrowers and hurt lenders. Deflations are so scary that there's not many economists around who would not want to be on the other side of the galaxy from a deflation. Deflations are scary. And we've had a little bit of a warning shot about that because of the bizarre policy that the Federal Reserve has taken. But I'm going to give you a brief tour, very brief, and then I'm going to come to a punchline with it. One of the basic rules of macroeconomics and finance. And then I'll move on to the structure of interest rates from there. But I have to have you know this part first. Look, the truth of the matter is that the money supply was growing at a ridiculously fast rate through the 60s, through the 70s, as the Federal Reserve under chairmen like Arthur Burns screwed around and fed federal government policy. They poured printed money with no backing in. And it built and built and built until by the end of the 1970s, we had created an inflationary environment so severe that interest rates were through the roof. Because every interest rate impounds not an inflation premium, but something far worse, an expected inflation premium. And if you think inflation is bad, expected inflation is worse. And that's what rational markets deal in, is expectations. Not realities. And I'll work on that with you in just a moment here. President Jimmy Carter, near the end of his term, finally cracked down. He appointed a brutal monetarist named Paul Volcker, who clamped down on the money supply very hard. It was the end of the era. We are not going to print money anymore. We are not going to. We have such an overhang of money. Here's the thing that I want to get to, and see if you already know this. If you don't, then that gauges something about your macroeconomics training. And it's okay if you don't, but it's okay if you do too. Talk to me, woman. If the money supply grows at a rate in excess of the real growth rate of the economy, in other words, the money supply is growing faster than the growth of the need for money, to complete transactions between businesses and households. What is the result of that? There is one and only one result. When the money supply grows faster than the real economy, what is the result? You don't know, do you? That's okay. That's okay. Can anyone tell me?
Prices go up.
What do you call that?
Inflation.
That's it. There is no alternative. There is no fantasy world, no hope, no prayer, no dream, no alternate theory that matters. If, say, the growth rate, the real growth rate of the economy is 3% and the money supply grows at 10%, you will have inflationary pressures moving towards 7%. You just will. There is no way around it. You can't fantasize a world where that will not happen eventually. Well, that was what the Federal Reserve was facing, years of a monetary overhang that finally got to the point. The Federal Reserve, here was the demand for money, and here was the price of money. Now let's try this. What's the price of money? Yeah, and we're going to be really diffuse about the word interest rate right now, because I've got to tie that word down, because we can use that in all kinds of ways. But there's a rental rate for money. R, we'll call it. Now, as the Federal Reserve kept pumping money into the economy, what it was trying to do was keep real interest rates down. It was trying to hold them down. But there was a problem with doing that, because those real interest rates were hiding an expected inflation premium. And the worse that expected inflation premium got, the more the Fed had to pour money in to try to hold the real interest rate down, to hold a balance of forces. It didn't work. expected inflation just kept getting worse and worse. So interest rates that people were seeing, the businesses were dealing with, kept going up slowly. So when the Fed cracked down on the money supply, it was a disaster for the economy. It had to happen, though. You see, because then real interest rates went through the roof, but the expected inflation premium was still there. So we had interest rates on home mortgages, and I was around. I was an adult at the time, 20, 25% interest rates on mortgages. It was insane. People wanted heads. They kicked Carter out of office, and they elected Ronald Reagan because he did a simpleton populist. Well, you know, I don't think interest rates should be this high. Oh, shut up, Ronald. You know exactly what's going on. You're not that stupid. Oh, yeah, you went to Eureka College. You are that stupid. Oh, that was harsh. And then, of course, it took a long time to shake the expected inflation premium out. People didn't believe it. Investors didn't believe it. Businesses didn't believe it. No one believed that inflation was gone because we'd heard that story. Oh, yeah, we're going to stop inflation. Gerald Ford, he even had buttons made up. Whip inflation now. Even Jimmy Carter, early in his term, he thought he could fight inflation by calling it a war. In fact, he called it the moral equivalent of war. M-E-O-W. Meow. That didn't work. Finally, you had to actually do the real thing and put Tall Paul Volcker in. Tall Paul Volcker didn't care. Nasty, tall man. Story was that he would blow cigar smoke in people's faces sometimes. He was that uncaring, not what you'd call a care bear at all. But eventually it worked, and we shook the inflation expectations out of the economy, and then Volcker could let loose on the money supply and let it grow. Interest rates began to sink, and we had a decent period of growth in the 1980s. We had an even better period of growth, the longest sustained growth period in U.S. history in the 1990s. And I can get into that a little later, what the forces were. But it was brilliant policy on the part of a Congress that was Republican and a president who was Democrat. Together, they saw to it that our economic policies were stable, the money supply was controlled very well, and the economy grew very nicely, beautifully, unbelievably, in fact. But then Alan Greenspan got spiteful. He didn't like this. He kept saying there's an irrational exuberance in the stock markets. They shouldn't go up like this. So he started trying to crush the money supply. He thought he could kill the economy. Interestingly, his greatest crushing of the money supply came in the year before the presidential election of 2000. Classic example, the Fed's done it before, trying to manipulate an election, throw us into a recession. It didn't happen. We didn't get the recession. But in 2001, Alan Greenspan got up before Congress and swore to God that we were in a recession and we needed the largest tax cuts in history, the longest tax cuts in history, to save the economy when there wasn't a recession. The data is clear. I put it in part four of my series, The Economics of Wreckage. No recession. Greenspan just wanted to create a crisis with the Bush administration. And sure enough, when you cut the taxes, the federal budget deficits began to explode, and then the Fed could execute monetary policy to save the world. Here's the upshot of it. In 2004, Ben Bernanke took over, and Ben Bernanke announced that the Fed was no longer going to print money to accommodate federal deficits. You see, here's how it works. If the federal government doesn't have enough tax revenue to pay for its expenditures, it must borrow. If it hits the capital markets of the world, the global capital markets, that is going to cause problems. It's going to cause interest rates to rise. It just will. As the supply of debt increases, and that would, as the borrower, that the U.S. Treasury would be the supplier of the debt, the price of debt would go down, which would drive yield up. As yield on Treasury debt goes up, yields on all instruments go up. That would hurt the economy. So the Federal Reserve printed money, had been printing money. Greenspan announced in 2004, when he came in, that the Federal Reserve would no longer provide accommodative monetary policy. In other words, the Federal Reserve would not go to the auctions and buy the debt. The Federal Reserve would no longer print money and go to the auctions to keep that debt from hitting the global capital markets. Well, that was actually a lie. You look at the numbers. I've got them right there on my website. You look at the graphs. All he did was cut M1 to down to the bone. That's the money that businesses and individuals use for their business transactions. M2, M3 were growing like wildfire, insanely, ridiculously. Now we're at the end. We've got a major problem. We've got massive debt piling up, even worse than in the Bush administration. We've got a Federal Reserve that doesn't dare back off. It's just got to keep printing money and go to the auctions. It has to. There's nothing else it can do. And all that's going to do is just build and build and build that overhang. And sooner or later, expected inflation will begin to embed. Let's do it this way. Now we get down to the brass tacks. I am your boss. I've been paying you a very attractive wage of $5 an hour. You come in to my office for your annual pay review. Well, you know, I've been looking at the numbers. You're a damn fine employee, yeah, as you are. And I think I'm going to give you a 4% increase. 4% increase in your pay for this coming year. Well, let the good times roll. Mm-hmm. We can finally subscribe to that internet porn site. Indeed. Well, here's the thing, though. Suppose that inflation 3 years ago was 1%. 2 years ago was 2%. Then last year it was 4%. Are you comfortable with a 4% pay increase for this year?
No.
Why not?
The interest, if it goes up anymore, it's like I'm almost getting paid less.
Well, not almost. You are. You see, it's not what historically happened. It's what you expect to happen that will drive your wage expectations. Just like a bank, it has nothing to do with what has happened to inflation. It's what the financial markets expect to happen with inflation. That's what they are going to key their inflation premium on, is not the reality, but the expectation. That's how all financial markets work. They don't work on reality. They work on the expectation of what is to come. Now, suppose you say, well, sir, I kind of think that inflation is going to be 6% next year. All right, well, I saw it was 4% last year. And besides, Ben Bernanke, that nice Ben Bernanke, he just got reappointed to the Fed, and he promised to whip inflation now. As I recall, he even called it the moral equivalent of war. What say you? I'll give you a clue. Bull. You know why? Because you can never, ever in business key your decisions on intentions, only on capabilities. Never, ever assess your opponent based upon claimed intentions. You assess on capability. You say, oh no, the Russians would never attack us. They said they won't attack us, do a first strike, so let's just dismantle all our nukes. Yes, they will. Al-Qaeda has declared that it's never going to attack us again because we have a president they like. So let's stop all Homeland Security. Let's get rid of all of it, okay? Yeah, okay. That car, I see him coming at me 60 miles an hour, but he's got such a kind face. He's going to slow down for me. The last second of your life, you see that it's me. Bad decision here on campus. Do not jaywalk in front of my ass, okay? Do you understand what I'm trying to get to? I do these things with these long-winded little hammers like this, and I'm trying to get you into a mode of thinking. In business, we cannot do things based upon promises unless we have power to make sure that those promises are to become reality. That means that we have to monitor. We have to enforce. Trust but verify, as the late, great Ronald Reagan said. We have to make sure that it's real. So when you come to me with your wage expectations to try to cover, at least to cover inflation. I mean, I'm not even talking about merit increase. We're just talking about inflation. You cannot base it upon promises of the Fed. You cannot base it upon the history of the economy. You have to base it upon forward expectations. What is going to happen? Not what we want to have happen. Not what someone promises us that will happen. But what our best estimate as intelligent, informed financial market participants, both in labor and in savings and in borrowing, tell us. So here we go. At the core of all interest rates, I'm actually going to draw this thing again here a little less sloppily. At the core of all interest rates is a seed interest rate. And this is one of those things that you cannot actually see. We cannot see this animal directly. As a matter of fact, even the one that is wrapped, the interest rate wrapped around the seed, we can't see directly. Now, we have econometric models, and one of my PhD field specializations was econometrics. So I can speak, actually, I've seen and I've actually used models where we can tease out an estimate of the seed that I'm talking about. But even at that, it's still an estimate. It's not the real animal. The real animal exists as something that we will never actually see for itself. It's not naked. It cannot be naked. It would not exist naked. But nevertheless, we know very well it's there. As a matter of fact, you're going to be using that quite a bit in this course, at least the wrapped version of it, when we do the capital asset pricing model later in the course. But for now, I call this the real interest rate. And I designate it as R sub real. R sub real. This is the pure opportunity cost of foregone consumption. The pure opportunity cost of foregone consumption. It is what the rental rate on money that must be earned in order for that money not to be used for consumption. In order for that money not to be used for consumption. Look, I'm willing to lend you money for cheeseburgers tonight. Okay, I really am. All right. But I mean, if I'd give you that money, I don't have money for cheeseburgers myself. So in order for me to do this, I have to be induced. There has to be a rental rate on that money. Otherwise, I won't do it. I just won't do it. But if you're willing to pay me enough, I will give up my consumption of cheeseburgers. I don't want to get this into some sexist term, but in the financial markets, it's not about whether, it's about how much. We're not negotiating whether we'll do this. We're just negotiating what our price is. Really. That's how financial markets work. There is a price for everything in this world. And my price for cheeseburgers? 14% on the $20 per day. But it's there. There is going to be a reward, but you cannot expect free money. You just cannot. Despite, God help me. I don't know if I have already told you that. The Federal Reserve is so desperate to start this economy up. It's got interest rates down to these insanely low levels. Right now, we're talking about a Fed funds rate that is somewhere between 0% and 0.5%. That's an insane. I have a couple of my former students who do financial work now at companies here in town. One of them actually, she came to me and said, am I doing this right? I've been doing this for like 2 years now. Look at what I found. She had been trying to buy up treasury bills. They used treasury bills to balance her portfolio through the day, create the proper liquidity structure. It's their way of doing things. She could not find treasury bills. She could not. She finally started finding a few treasury bills out there. The Fed's just absorbing them, just buying them up. Of course, as the Fed buys them up, that drives the prices up. Demand increases, price increases, which drives yields down. Well, she was just desperate. Finally, at the end of the day, she got some T-bills, bought them at a stupidly high price, did the calculation she'd been doing on her Excel spreadsheet, and it came up with a negative number. Do you understand? That means that the yields on the T-bills she was buying at the prices they were commanding at near the end of the day, and this wasn't on one day, this was over a period of days, were negative. The government was borrowing money, and the lenders were literally paying to lend the money. Now, here's a rule. That should not happen. I went through the numbers myself. I thought, I've heard this is going on, but I saw the numbers. The prices, did the calculation myself by hand. Well, not by hand, with a calculator, not the Excel. They're negative interest rates. You shouldn't have negative interest rates. That's the weirdest ass thing in the world. Okay, look. Taking the current period aside, when all reality should be suspended because God knows it's a strange time we're in, the real interest rate would be a small positive number. It would be a small positive number. It doesn't take much for us to give up just pure consumption. It really doesn't. For you and I, yeah, it would hurt like hell. We'd want a lot of money. But for big, heavy-duty, industrial-strength financial markets, just the pure opportunity cost of foregone consumption, not a big thing. Not really a major thing at all, not large. So this is like the core, the seed. And it is driven by the supply and demand conditions for money. Now, if you remember, and please, God, tell me you remember that the supply curve of money is straight up and down. You do remember that, right? Deer in the headlights. Do tell me you remember that. Why is the supply curve of money straight up and down? Because at any given flash point in time, there's just a fixed stock of money in the economy. There's a certain amount that is in the banks and in people's pockets. It's not like it can be the amount of money in the economy at any point in time can be affected by the interest rates. It's just a fixed stock of money that's there. That's why it's a vertical line. Never mind, it's a vertical line. Okay, whatever. Okay, and what these two do is the interaction of supply and demand establishes an equilibrium real interest rate, which we would call R1. Associated with supply curve 1 and demand curve 1. And over time, if the Federal Reserve increases the money supply, R1 can fall. The real interest rate can fall. But you see, here's where it gets a little bit fuzzy. There's a problem with going too far with explaining this, because if you talk about too far in time, this real interest rate begins to fuzz over to the one I was talking about before, that real interest rate wrapped with something else. So I have to stop right there and say this would be a very short-run scenario where the supply and demand dynamics are such that this interest rate is established. This would represent, for a given snapshot period of time, a very short period of time, the opportunity cost of foregone consumption for the marginal agents in the financial markets. Now, get that off the board before I start nuancing myself out of business here. Get that off the board. Okay. Now, we had our conversation. You were bitching about what I was going to give you for a raise to cover cost of living. You are no different. Well, actually, you are different from capital markets. In this, you're no different in the fact that they will certainly expect to have to not just get reward for their work, but rewarded for the erosion of their purchasing power over the life of the contract. So they're going to put in an expectation of inflation. You see, the difference between you and them is you're both going to want to do this. They will do it. You can't do it because I'm your boss and I said no. But the reality is in the financial markets, they will do it just like that. They won't even think about it. It will happen as a result of the ebbs and flows of millions of participants establishing the balance of what is the group, the herd assessment of expected inflation. So what will happen is that this real interest rate, which we never see, we can't see this thing, will be augmented by an expected inflation premium, which in my old terminology from the old days, we designate as a pi superscript E, the expected inflation premium. Bundled together, we begin to see the outline of the first interest rate that might be viewable by the world. Unfortunately, because this is a theoretical animal, and this is a herd assessment that would be moving around in time, and we couldn't really, we can't take a poll of the entire financial world. What's the expected inflation premium for today? We can't do those things. So both of these are somewhat fuzzy to us in terms of our real ability to see them. Fortunately, there is an animal out there, a financial instrument, that we know is extraordinarily close to this, if not the same thing, sort of like a real-world version of a unicorn. I don't think I should use the word unicorn. A real-world version of a winning Redbirds football team. No. Oh, easy. God. U of I. I mean, I'm surprised they're still there. Where's the trustees? Oh, they were all fired. Boy, that's a nasty scandal. But how would I put it? A real world version of a sane Cubs fan. No, that's not working. All right, let me just look. Let me shut up now and say, look. Put together R sub real plus pi E. The sum of the real interest rate and the expected inflation premium is called the risk-free rate, designated by R sub F. Designated by R sub F. Now, this is, again, theoretical. We don't see it. But, as I said, there is a real-world instrument that we use all the time as a proxy for this. You will use it as a proxy. We will actually be implementing R sub F quite a bit. When we use the capital asset pricing model, we need R sub F. But we don't have R sub F, so what are we going to do? We're going to use the next best thing. That's a short-term U.S. Treasury debt instrument. Its yield has got to be theoretically very close, if not right on, R sub F. A short-term T-bill, the yield on it, that's as good as we're ever going to get for R sub F, and it works every time. When I give you problems to apply capital asset pricing model, CAPM, or some of the other things that use R sub F in the theoretical formula, you go right to the short-term T-bill yield. That's what you use. Because, look, a short-term U.S. Treasury bill is riskless. It really is. The only things that could possibly be in there are a reward for foregone consumption and an expected inflation premium that the markets are going to insist upon. That's just going to be it. There's not going to be a default premium because the U.S. government will not default on its debt. No, it won't. The U.S. government, if it's in trouble, the Fed will just print money to pay off the debts. Now, isn't that comforting? But it just is not going to happen. Well, the weirdest thing was there's this group, and I had no idea this was out there. I wrote an article on one of my big websites, and some person came in and said, my group is dedicated to getting the United States government to clear its debt obligations by going bankrupt. Yes, we believe that the U.S. government should just simply declare that it will no longer pay any of its old debt instruments. End the national debt, 3 exclamation points, and then a link to some stupid-ass Facebook account. I didn't take it now. I don't believe in deleting posts unless they're just pure commercial advertisements or the people are complete morons. But, I mean, I came back. I think every word that I used to in addressing him, I started with mother. God. And then what was really creepy, I actually couldn't stand it. I went to the Facebook site. Over 10,000 members. What? Yeah, we're going to really default our debt. Now, that's going to work real good. Watch the global financial capital markets collapse into a heaping, I get so, weirdest ass, stupid ass people. Don't join that group. I'll fail your ass. Anyway. Of course, the problem is, in my business, I am heavily critical of the Fed, but that puts me in the same league with people like Ron Paul's followers who want the Fed abolished. So here I am trying to be rational and explain the real deep problems with the Fed, and I've got these right-wing Nazis slapping me. You tell them, boss, the Fed must die. Kill Bernanke. No, I didn't say that. Quit that. Look, you're never going to get that interest rate on a loan. Arsabef, dream on. You're not going to get it. You will never have that. You don't get that loan rate. Why? Because you are not the federal government. You are not safe. You are risky. I mean, look at him. That's what gives you your appeal. That slightly risky, debonair. Is he going to drive a motorcycle tonight? Will he use Bod cologne? Yes. See, we are riskier than the federal government. There's a chance we will default. Hell, I would. You would. Can you print money to pay off your debts? Well, you could, but then the Secret Service would arrest you. So, but you see, we do not have the facility of the sovereign. You see, the sovereign has two powers that no one else has. The sovereign has the power of the police, and the sovereign has the power of the printing presses for money. So if it wants to raise taxes, it can raise them and take the money from you. You can't stop it. It also has the power of the printing presses for the money. If the sovereign wants to print its way out of debt, it can do it. And you can't stop it. I mean, God knows there were a lot of us who wanted to stop Bernanke from getting reappointed. We couldn't stop it. It was not something that we had any power over. So here we go. We're not going to get R-sub-F. We're going to get R-sub-F with these premia on it, these risk premia. Now, there's a disingenuity right embedded in when I say the interest rate. Well, we all know that there are many interest rates. There's the interest rate on a home loan. There's the interest rate on a credit card. There's the interest rate on a student loan. There's the interest rate on a car loan. There's the interest rate I would charge you on a loan. So there are all these different interest rates out here. And it's these three terms I put here, that I'm about to put here, that determine what the actual value of a given interest rate would be. Look, the first of those values that is added on is a default premium, R sub D. Default premium. The default premium is the reward for the risk, the reward for the risk that part or all of the cash flow arising from a claim, that part or all of the cash flow arising from a claim will not be satisfied. That part or all of the cash flow arising from a claim will not be satisfied. In other words, I am going to take a little out of your hide, put a little extra premium on an interest rate to cover the chance that you won't pay it, part of it or all of it. And the problem is, notice that this would be different for different financial instruments. And it would be different at different points in time. You know, a lot of people are defaulting on their homes right now, defaulting on home loans, home mortgages. Well, so wouldn't you expect bankers to be putting a higher default premium on? So everyone has to pay more for the risk that some will not pay their mortgages? So that happens in a time like this. R sub D would be a little higher than it would in a time when everyone's well off and everyone's paying their mortgage obligations on time. Moreover, think about this. A home loan would have a very small R sub D compared to a credit card. Because a home loan is collateralized. A mortgage loan is a promissory note collateralized by an annex called the mortgage instrument, which means that if the person doesn't pay, the borrower doesn't pay, the bank can get the house. That sort of creates a lower floor on it. It's even better than that for a bank, because banks actually make people who have loan-to-value ratios above 80%, banks make them pay an insurance premium in case they default. And you never hear much about that. Banks are covered very well. So you would expect a home loan to have a small R sub D compared to a credit card debt, which is collateralized by nothing. That's why credit card debt, the principal reason credit card interest rates are so high. You see credit card rates like 18%. It's just ridiculous. Why? Because if you default, they don't have a whole lot of recourse. The lender doesn't on that. Student loans, low interest rate because it's a low default premium. Why is it a low default premium? Because the government promises the banks that it will take care of them if you default. And then the government will come after you. And believe me, you don't want the government coming after you. I mean, it can get ugly. And so the default premium on a student loan is low. That's why the government guarantees them. In fact, the government, through several organizations, has historically been guaranteeing home loans too. So essentially, the government is promising that if a bank loses its shirt, the government will take care of some of what happened. These are what we call VA loans. FHA loans are like that. And the secondary mortgage markets you hear about, like Ginnie Mae and Freddie Mac, all they are is aggregators, buyers, bundlers of those loans from different guaranteeing programs of the government. There's Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and there's even one for student loans. You got your student loan in a bank? The bank doesn't have that student loan anymore. It's out there in a secondary mortgage market. They bundle a bunch of them together and sell them to these huge, powerful investors. Usually foreign investors. And those are called Sallie Mae's. Why are they called Sallie Mae's? Not because they're student loans, but because they are guaranteed, their performance is guaranteed under a program for student loans. So that's why they have low interest rates. And there's another reason you'll see here in a minute they have lower interest rates too. But let me get to the next one. There's your default premium. This one really drives a lot of interest rates. It really makes interest rates different from one instrument to the next. The next one is the maturity premium. This is a reward for the risk of cash flow over long periods of time. The risk of the timing of cash flow over long periods of time. I wanted to say the thing about it like this. Look, you need money for 20 years, say $100,000. And now one way we could do this is that I could lend you the money for a year. And then we just have this workout that every year I'll lend you whatever is left on the loan. So that essentially it is a 20-year loan, but we would just rewrite the contract once every year. Now let's set that one aside. I just wanted to bring that one up. It's a possibility. Now let's get real. I'm going to lend you money at, let's say, 8% for 20 years. Now I have an expectation as an investor in you. I am buying your debt instrument. You understand that? You're selling a debt instrument, I'm buying it. That's how you're getting the $100,000, is the price, okay? So, now let's say that during the life of that loan, Now, over 20 years, a lot can happen. A lot more can happen than over 1 year. A lot more can happen than over 5 years. Let's say that during that 20 years, interest rates go down to 4% over the life of that 20-year loan. Sometime during that. Surely over 20 years, there's a chance of a lot of things happening. What are you going to do as the borrower if interest rates fall to 4%? Logically, rationally, greedily. Anyone want to help him out? Yeah, he's going to refi. Why would you hold on to an 8% loan, pay me 8%, if you could get the loan from someone else for 4% and give me back my money? Then I get all pissy at you. What the hell, man? I was expecting 8% for 20 years, and you screw me. Yeah, that's really nice of you. Thank you. Okay, now let's talk about, okay, well, interest rates could go through the roof. Interest rates could go through the roof. Let's say interest rates go up to 15%. You've got an 8% loan. I'm an investor. You know, I'd really, really, really like him to pay his loan off so I could lend it to someone else at 15% now that interest rates have gone up. Are you going to do that for me? Oh, hell no. You're going to hold on to that loan. You see that on both sides, that long-term debt obligation that I have worked out with him is adverse to me. Whichever way interest rates swing, I get burned. And so the longer the instrument exists, the longer the time to maturity, the more likely it is I'm going to get burned on either the downside or the upside, or maybe even both. That's why we have a maturity premium. Long-term debt instruments will have an extra little reward in them for me because I need a little extra for the fact that I could get burned on either side. So I'm going to take it from you, whether you like it or not. Okay? Last one. The book uses one term, and I've always used another slightly different term, but I have to say it makes more sense to call it what the book calls it. I've always called it the liquidity premium, but the book calls it the illiquidity premium, which is actually a much more logical term. The illiquidity premium, and I write it as Arcibel anyway, illiquidity premium. And the illiquidity premium works like this. It's not a difficult concept at all. As a matter of fact, I forgot again. I don't have any. I know what's going to happen. Okay. Who looks respectable in here? Damn. This is going to be tough. Okay, I know what it is. You and I both need $100. And we have Ms. Banker here who could lend us money. Now, this is going to work out just 1 year. We'd pay you back $100 in a year. $100 in a year. And you would lend us a certain amount under $100 now. So it'll be a discount, like a T-bill. In other words, you might lend $90, and that means you'd earn $10 on $90. Okay? So now this man comes in dressed nicely. He comes from a fine family in the upscale part of Normal. He looks well-heeled. He comes in with legal financial papers, debt obligation, promissory note, and all that kind of stuff, all even on parchment, no less. Printed at the local Kinko's. And he says, I should like to borrow some money, and this instrument represents that I will pay you back $100 in a year. So you say, well, yes, everything looks in order, sir, so I shall lend you $90. Now, I shall lend you $90, okay? So that's all fine. So you've got a paper in your hand that represents a claim on cash flows. This is an asset for you. It's something that you could actually sell. If you needed the money earlier than a year, you could actually sell it to someone else. You could sell it to him, and then he would get the $100 in a year. So you could actually transact this asset, just like a lot of companies sell their debt Banks sell their debt all the time. Credit card companies sell their credit card debt. Accounts receivable are sold all the time. So you could certainly sell this instrument. It's on nice paper from a very nice young man. He's got a bright future. He's going to make a lot of money. He's so attractive that he's probably cougar bait. He's going to be some gigolo. He'll be taken care of anyway. So he'll have the money. He's good for it. Now here I come in. I am a street bum. I come in to you.
I just wrote down an IOU. I owe you $100. I'll pay you back in a year. I need some money now. Yeah. Here's your damn promissory note. It's all legal.
It is legal. This is a promissory note. This is legal. It's executed. Offer acceptance if she accepts. Capacity. Mutual consideration, legality, they're all there. This is a contract. This is perfectly valid.
Yeah, here's your damn piece of paper. Now give me some money. Right now. Yeah. Chop, chop.
You going to give me $90? I'm going to be lucky if you give me $2 from your purse. Price goes down. What happens to yield? Yield goes up. Right? Price goes down, yield goes up. Now, it's not just because I seem to be a worse default. You check our credit ratings. Our credit ratings are perfectly matching. You say, WTF. But turns out I'm actually a finance professor at a very good university, but on the weekends I just kind of burn out. Matter of fact, there's even rumors that I blog on the weekends. Yes. God, if you ever get a chance, go to my Twitter. I have a Twitter. I have two Twitter accounts. Both of them are economics related. One's called Pulp Economics. Look at the people who follow my Twitter account. Look at their pictures. It should scare the hell out of you. I mean, these are freaking... Why would someone with a picture of a bare ass be following my... No, you go and you look at my... I mean, what? And it's not just one. It's like a bunch. What? Anyway, where the hell was I? Try, concentrate, please. Okay, it's not just the default premium. It's not default premium at all. It's not maturity premium. And the risk-free rate is fixed for all instruments. It's the same for everyone. So the fact of the matter, it has everything to do with how quickly you could sell this instrument versus how quickly you could dispose of his instrument. I saw this all the time in stock brokering. In a penny stock house, I dealt in these companies no one had ever heard of before. And I'd have, they'd be listed. There's no question. I'd have an OTC. That was the 15C211. Get that all done. So they were actually running on an OTC. You could pull them up and see them. But I'd have maybe four market makers, thin as hell market. You see, when someone wanted to sell, someone had bought it a couple of years ago, when someone wanted to sell it, good God, it would take me sometimes weeks to find a buyer to match the seller on it. And ultimately, the market makers, they would buy for their own inventory. But they were sure as hell going to buy at a low price because it took them forever to find someone to match up to get it back out of their inventory after they had bought some of this stock. So you see, that's that trick again. See how as the price sinks, the yield rises. And it's as true with common stock as it is with debt instruments. That was purely liquidity premium. In some cases, the stock was, we printed it on paper that we had bought at Walmart, the stock certificates. It was that sad sometimes. We were lucky. Well, I wasn't so lucky. They shut down my damn store. But anyway. Damn the regulators. But you put all of these together, you have an interest rate. R sub F plus R sub D plus R sub M plus R sub L, that is an interest rate. That's the thing right there. There it is. And so, when we talk about interest rates, when I say interest rate, the discount rate on future expected cash flows, you see that that is not just a lump, an amorphous mass. It is actually a detailed structure that includes some things that are macroeconomic. Like right now, the Fed's trying to keep down interest rates. Well, R sub D is going up, which makes the Fed's job harder. And also, pi e, the expected inflation rate. You keep pouring money into the economy too long, pi e begins to balloon, and you are no longer having effective monetary policy. You begin to go into a death spiral. You have to print more money to push R real down, which pushes pi e up even worse, and ultimately a reckoning happens. That's where we're eventually going to get. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.